I'm going to present a little bit of introductory material. I'm going to read some cases from different cultures and so on that I have gathered, mostly with Gracia Fay's help, on the NDE. And then I'm going to try to open this up and hear if any of you know of cases of it, or you know, or you have perspectives on it. Anything like that would be tremendously interesting and very helpful to me. I assume that most of you probably know what we're talking about when we say the near-death experience, or NDE, as I will be calling it quite often this evening. Experiences that have frequently been reported of people near death or even clinically dead, but who have been resuscitated, who have said that during this time when they were in effect dead or seemed to be, that they had some very interesting experiences. Experiences of light, of going through a tunnel, of encountering people in the other world, and things like that. The near-death experience, or NDE, together with the closely related phenomenon of deathbed visions, has attracted a considerable degree of interest worldwide, particularly since the 1970s. And this is due primarily to the influence of two books, Carlos Osis and Erlander Haraldsson's At the Hour of Death, 1977, and especially Raymond Moody's Life After Life, which was first published in 1975 and became one of those sleepers that was a sensational bestseller. And these have been followed by a plethora of subsequent books, or in a few cases preceding but rediscovered works, exploring the topic from a variety of perspectives, such as the writings of Kenneth Ring on the experience's psychological and metaphysical significance, or Maurice Sebaum on medical and evidential aspects, Melvin Morse on the NDEs of children, and many others. Now, one striking aspect of the NDE is the extent to which the basic structure of the phenomenon seems to be similar cross-culturally. While, as one might expect, aspects of it are often interpreted by experiencers in light of their own religious language, some constants remain obtained very widely, as we shall see. Much further research remains to be done in the cross-cultural area. Of course, one thing that I'm really hoping to stimulate in this presentation at the Parliament is precisely that experience by people from the many different religious traditions that are represented there. But there is enough to suggest the basic hypothesis of this presentation, and that is that in the crucial religious areas of life after death and the transcendent destiny of the soul, some general empirical realities may underlie the diverse doctrines of the world's religious traditions, and so could provide a foundation for religious, interreligious understanding at a very basic level. The NDE could suggest that however we phrase it, we are all talking about the same thing when we talk about what happens in life after death. Now, of course, some people might suggest that we're talking about nothing at all. Strenuous efforts have been made to explain the NDE naturalistically, in a way that would deny any cognitive value to it as a means of obtaining valid knowledge about death or the afterlife. It has been interpreted as a result of medication, of anoxia, as a sensory deprivation phenomenon, a replay of the birth process, a psychological response to the depersonalization of the death process, among other etiologies. The false memory syndrome, which has recently received much attention in connection with these unprovable memories of alleged Satanist abuse and UFO abductions, has also been entered on the skeptic side. I cannot undertake to discuss and critique these arguments here, nor am I qualified to do so in every case. But I would like to make a couple of remarks about them. First, I am not convinced, on the basis of such study as I have done, that any or all of the naturalistic explanations fully account for all of the phenomena that has been reported. And here I'd like to kind of insert something that came to my attention just a couple of days ago, and that is that here at the Parliament, I picked up a copy of The American Humanist at the booth of the American Humanist Association there in the exhibit room because it contained an article by Gerald LaRue. Gerald LaRue is a former colleague of mine at the University of Southern California. He taught Old Testament there for many years, so he's now emeritus. and during his time with us, he kind of made a personal pilgrimage from being a minister of United Church of Canada to being a very outspoken humanist and stalwart of the American Humanist Association. As you may know, these humanists are people that are profoundly skeptical of religious truth claims, you know, the sort of people that believe only in scientific, this worldly kind of interpretations of human life. Jerry LaRue is a very interesting person, although I don't agree with him on many things. He's an unforgettable type of personality. He's not one of these sort of sour Puritan kind of humanists who are mainly debunking of psychical stuff or anything else, but to him I think this is a kind of way in which he affirms living life to the hilt and enjoying it thoroughly here in this world and, you know, not worrying about every other world. He talks and writes vividly about the pleasures of being hugged and caressed, of driving his sports car into the sunset and things like that. And to him, that's kind of what life is all about. I don't mean that he's just a hedonist. He's also a very compassionate and warm person. But anyway, the point is that he wrote an article for the American Humanist, which I picked up there, on the subject of the afterlife. And what interested me was that he went through all of the, you know, kind of arguments for an afterlife. Such things as ghosts and mediumistic communication and past life regressions and, you know, many things like that that have been done recently and before. And he dismissed all of those. You know, they're totally unprovable and not even hardly worth bothering about. But when he came to the near-death experience, he seemed unable to do that. You know, he went through all of these things that I just mentioned, the arguments that it's a result of medication, that it's a kind of psychological replay of birth and the depersonalization, anxiety, and so on. And he had to acknowledge, as I would too, that none of those explanations seem to cover all that appears in the NDE, that you know, it may explain a few cases here and there, but it just doesn't explain the whole body of material that we have. And for all of his agnosticism, he had to end up saying that you know, he couldn't dismiss the NDE experience, even though he doesn't think it really proves an afterlife. He simply can't explain where it comes from or exactly what it is. Others, of course, might say that, well, admittedly, it doesn't exactly prove absolutely an afterlife, that it seems to certainly point in the direction of some dimension of human life that goes beyond the present. However, for my own part in this particular presentation, you know, I'm not really qualified to analyze all of that, and that's not what I'm going to do this evening. I simply want to say that whatever the psychophysiological basis of the experience, functionally they are religious experiences. And as a historian of religion, it is from that perspective that I am equipped to deal with them. For many of these experiencers, they have had a profound life-transforming impact, comparable to a major mystical or conversion experience. And usually that impact has been interpreted by the experiencer in some sense as religious or spiritual, though not always in an orthodox sense. And the nature of the experience and its meaning have common features that cut across the lines of conventional orthodoxies. Now, there are two ways in which this commonality of experience could be approached. One would be through comparing contemporary NDE experiences with persons of different religious backgrounds. And here, though the material is unfortunately scanty, and I hope will be enhanced, examples have been published from India, Israel, Melanesia, Native American cases, as well as the US, Europe, and Australia. And it might be added that the rich material in the Moody and the Osis Haraldson book and many other researchers, though on US, European, Australian, and other Western experiencers, nonetheless reflect the highly different religious backgrounds, or no religious background at all, of these cultures. And we'll look at some of these in a moment. Another approach would be through comparing the view and experience of death and the afterlife in classical sources of the great religions with the scenario suggested by modern NDEs. Raymond Moody presented brief but highly suggestive comparisons with such texts as Plato's Phaedo, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and the works of Swedenborg. Carl Becker has done important work on the NDE and Chinese Pure Land Buddhism, Carol Zaleski, in her important work, Other World Journeys, compared them with ancient and medieval Christian texts. I'll be presenting some examples of all of these in a moment. Others have suggested parallels with Dante and his possible source, legendary Islamic accounts of the ascension of Muhammad. And it should also be mentioned that many 19th century spiritualist and theosophical writings display marked congruence with the NDE picture of death and the afterlife too. So what is this picture? First of all, I'd like to present a couple of cases from Moody and then from Moses and Haraldson, and then Moody's composite narrative of an NDE to kind of put it into focus. Well, here's a couple of cases from Moody. One, I was hospitalized for a severe kidney condition, and I was in a coma for approximately a week. My doctors were extremely uncertain whether I would live. During this period, when I was unconscious, I felt as though I were lifted right up, just as though I didn't have a physical body at all. A brilliant white light appeared to me. The light was so bright that I could not see through it, but going into its presence was so calming and so wonderful. There is just no experience on earth like it. In the presence of the light, the thoughts or words come to my mind, "Do you want to die?" And I replied that I didn't know, since I knew nothing about death. Then the white light said, "Come over this line and you will learn." I felt that I knew where the line was in front of me, although I could not actually see it. As I went across the line, the most wonderful feelings came over me, feelings of peace, tranquility, a vanishing of all worries. And then a second example, these are all from contemporary America, of course. I had a heart attack and found myself in a black void, and I knew that I had left my physical body behind. I knew I was dying, and I thought, "God, I did the best I knew how at the time I did it. Please help me." Immediately, I was moved out of that blackness through a pale gray, and I just went on, gliding and moving swiftly, and in front of me in the distance, I could see a gray mist, and I was rushing toward it. It seemed that I just couldn't get to it fast enough to satisfy me, and as I got closer, I could see through it. Beyond the mist, I could see people, and their forms were just like they are on earth, and I could also see something which one could take to be buildings. The whole thing was permeated with the most gorgeous light, a living golden yellow glow, a pale color, not like the harsh gold color we know on earth. As I approached more closely, I felt that I was going through that mist. It was such a wonderful, joyous feeling, there are just no words in human language to describe it. Yet it wasn't my time to go through the mist, because instantly from the other side appeared my Uncle Carl, who had died many years earlier. He blocked my path, saying, "Go back. Your work on earth has not been completed. Go back now." I didn't want to go back, but I had no choice, and immediately I was back in my body. I felt that horrible pain in my chest, and I heard my little boy crying, "God, bring my mommy back to me." to give a different cultural perspective, here is an example from the Moses Haraldson book of an Indian patient in his 40s suffering from a liver disease in India. He was receiving no, this is in the third person unlike the others, he was receiving no sedation, had a light fever, and appeared confused, only able to respond to questions with difficulty, although he seemed aware of his surroundings and the people around him. He described his experience both as it took place and also afterward. The patient told of how he felt himself to be flying or moving in the air into another world, where he saw God sitting and calling him. He wanted to go there and ask the people around him to let him go. "Go away from me, I am dying," he said. The patient was very happy to see those gods. He had this hallucination twice, and he insisted it was not a hallucination but a true experience. He was elated after his experience and said that that was the world he wanted to live in. Before the elucidation, he had not wanted to die. He was very much concerned about his illness, and the doctor should help him. After the elucidation, he was not concerned about dying. He looked better and felt very happy about his experience. An hour or two later, he went into a deep coma, never regained consciousness. He died 2 days later. And here is Raymond Moody's composite account This has sometimes been criticized because nobody actually has everything in this experience all at once, but it's puts in most of the features that he has found in various different experiences. So it's a way of kind of getting a handle on it anyway. A man is dying, and as he reaches the point of greatest physical distress, he hears himself pronounced dead by his doctor. He begins to hear an uncomfortable noise, a loud ringing or buzzing, and at the same time feels himself moving very rapidly through a long dark tunnel. After this, he suddenly finds himself outside of his own physical body, but still in the immediate physical environment. And he sees his own body from a distance, as though he is a spectator. He watches the resuscitation attempt from this unusual vantage point and is in a state of emotional upheaval. After a while, he collects himself and becomes more accustomed to his odd condition. He notices that he still has a body, but one of very different nature and with very different powers from the physical body he has left behind. Some other things begin to happen. Others come to meet and help him. He glimpses the spirits of relatives and friends who have already died, and a loving, warm spirit of a kind he has never encountered before, a being of light, appears before him. This being asks him a question, non-verbally, to make him evaluate his life and helps him along by showing him a panoramic, instantaneous playback of the major events of his life. At some point, he finds himself approaching some sort of barrier or border, apparently representing the limit between earthly life and the next life. Yet, he finds that he must go back to the earth, that the time for his death has not yet come. At this point, he resists, for by now he has taken up with his experiences in the afterlife and does not want to return. He is overwhelmed by intense feelings of joy, love, and peace. Despite his attitude, though, he somehow reunites with his physical body and lives. Later he tries to tell others, but has trouble doing so. In the first place, he can find no human words adequate to describe these unearthly experiences. He also finds that others scoff, so he stops telling other people. Still, the experience affects his life profoundly, especially his views about death and its relationship to life. On that last point, I might mention that Raymond Moody has also said, as I think other people that have lectured and so on the NDE have said, and that is that you can't lecture to any audience about it without somebody coming up at the end and saying, well, I had that experience, but I never told anybody about it, or I told one or two people and they couldn't handle it or laughed at it or put it down or something, so I just kept quiet about it. Going on to some cross-cultural examples. First, some more material from the Osis Harlinson book about India. They make the comment that in their visions, Western patients did not see personifications of death. However, quite a few Indians did. Yama is the god of death in Indian mythology. Yamduts are his messengers who, according to Indian folklore, come for the dying. They can, some believe, take many forms, and they come to take people to the realm of the dead, the form of their appearance depending on the kind of life the person has lived. And quite a few of the Indian NDEs, unlike, of course, the Western ones, have these Yamduts in them. An educated lady in her 60s was admitted to the hospital for a checkup, there being no clear diagnosis. This is from a doctor, and he says, I examined her carefully. She had a slight fever, but otherwise seemed normal. After the examination, I remember her telling me, I will recover. I answered, no doubt you will. You simply have a fever, and after the investigation, you can go home. Some 20 hours later, she told visiting relatives that someone was whispering in her ear, your time is over. Come with me. The relatives asked who it was. Yamdut. The patient told this story two or three times. After that, she became quiet and calm, became self-conscious, and expired 2 or 3 hours later. This story is unusual, they comment, in that it's auditory rather than visual. And the Yamdut is not always peaceful. An experienced male nurse reported the following case. The patient, a Hindu policeman in his 40s, was suffering from pulmonary tuberculosis. He had at that time a low fever and had to be lightly touched or shaken before he would respond to questions. Suddenly he said, Yamdut is coming to take me away. Take me down from the bed so that Yamdut does not find me. He pointed outwards and upwards. There he is. The hospital room is on a ground floor. Outside at the wall of the building, there was a large tree with a great number of crows sitting on its branches. Just as the patient had his vision, all the crows flew away from the tree with much noise as if someone had fired a gun. We were very surprised at this and ran outside through an open door in the room, but we saw nothing that might have disturbed the crows. They were unusually peaceful, so it was very memorable of all of us present when the crows flew away, exactly at the time the patient had his vision. It was as if they too became aware. As this happened, the patient fell into a coma and expired a few moments later. And then a case from Melanesia. This is actually from New Britain Island, a part of Papua New Guinea now. And so it's in a much more kind of primal, I guess, Neolithic culture than the others. Andrew is a young man who lives in the Anum-speaking interior village of Bolo. His death occurred at the small hamlet of Vuvu, which is located about a kilometer from Bolo. His experience, which was well known throughout the area, was thought to be especially remarkable because during his vision he saw the spirit of a woman whose death had occurred shortly after his and about which he could have had no knowledge. And his account goes like this. The day I died, I was very sick and was sleeping in my house. I died at noon and came back about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. At the time I died, there was a woman who hadn't died. She cooked food and distributed. But when I died, my spirit met hers on the road. And it turned out that she actually had, of course. When I died, everything was dark. But I went through a field of flowers and came out, everything was clear. I walked on along the road and came to a fork where there were two men standing, one on either road. Each of them told me to come that way. I didn't have time to think about it, so I followed one of them. The man took my hand and we entered a village. There we found a long ladder that led up to a house. We climbed the ladder, but when we got to the top, I heard a voice saying, "It isn't time for you to come. Stay there. I'll send a group of people to take you back." I heard his voice, but I couldn't see his face or his body. And then he describes how there were different things that he saw in that house, people making things out of iron and making cars and buildings and things like that. I was to come back, but there was no road for me to follow, so the voice said, "Let him go down." Then there was a beam of light, and I walked along it. I walked down the steps, and when I turned to look, there was nothing but forest. I stood there and thought, if they have started mourning for me, I won't go back because the voice said, "Stand there and listen." So I walked on the beam of light through the forest and along a narrow path. I came back to my house and re-entered my body and was alive again. And finally, a case from Israel, which is particularly interesting because there are references to Kabbalism and other Jewish mystical things in it. It's rather long, so I'm going to have to condense some of it. The basic point is that the narrator, a young man, was put into intensive care in the hospital. And I remember that as I sank down, I felt that I was sinking and rolling, sinking and falling. As I continued to sink, the darkness around me thickened. Fear took hold of me. I was aware that the speed of my fall was accelerating in relation to time. I stretched out my hand in the darkness, searching for something to grip in order to break the force of acceleration. But all around me was only the void. I continued to fall at increasing speed. I surrendered to my fate. I knew that in another moment the impact would come. With a broken heart, I cried out, "From the depths I call unto you, O Lord." Lines from Psalm 130. The echo of my cry had hardly died when I felt the force of my fall becoming slower. The fall had turned into a soft, gentle landing until I was hanging in the dark void. I took a breath. I strained my eyes and tried to find a focus. In every direction I saw nothing. I shouted for help but heard nothing, not even the sound of my own cry. I stretched out my hand to the sides to feel, but there was nothing. I felt panic and fear of the absolute nothingness. I realized it was hovering over a sea of unknown nothingness. Suddenly I sensed that every movement of mine, even the slightest motion, changed my position and propelled me upward. I wanted to get out of there to escape the oppressive darkness. and wanted to return and began to move my limbs madly. I rose quickly, I began to glide. The darkness became lighter, less dense, its colors lighter and lighter until light returned. There I was again. Everything was familiar, the door frame that I had grasped. In the same moment, I noticed that someone was lying there on the floor in a contorted position. I stopped to look at him. I was astonished and bewildered, for I knew him. I recognized the person who lay there. He was none other than myself. And then he suddenly realized that he was not alone, that many like him were surrounding him, all in motion. He was surprised by the brilliance of a new light that had no source. The light itself was myriads of flames and auras, hints and twos, hues. I touched aura after aura, flame after flame, each twisting and growing larger, quivering and separating. They changed their shape and their very being. They became part of the endless stream. The sound no less than the light amazed me. And he realized that he was a different being in a new reality. A window had been opened for him to see the meaning of continuous changing creation. But then he turned back once again to his body, and at that point he saw his father. His father had died previously, and apparently the father was a very strong personality with whom he had had a somewhat difficult relationship. And he says, "Father looked at me with his penetrating eyes and serious expression, and a voice of silence asked of me, 'What are you doing here?' And he said to him, 'Please, Father, help me. Stretch out your hand and pull me up.' But his father said, 'What are you doing here?' And he answered, 'I brought tools with me, black paints and brushes. I want to paint and to engrave on the rock of this hill the verse, "Remember, you shall love the stranger, the orphan, and the widow."' 'What nonsense,' his father said. 'Those words have been written in the book for thousands of years.' But he says he wanted to paint them there. But his father's face grew furious, and he reproached me, 'You and your foolishness, now at this time, the hour is very late. Go back, my son, lest it be too late.' And so at that point, he returned to his body and recovered." Now going on to a few different types of NDE experiences. There have been some, which I think have been alluded to in some of these, that are not entirely pleasant. In fact, there's a category being increasingly studied, I think, called hellish type of NDEs. Here's an example from Australia. A woman who had an automobile accident. The accident happened on 5th April 1981. I had been out and was driving a friend home. It was a very bad night. The weather was really bad. It was raining very hard. I had dropped him off at his home, and I made a U-turn to go back up the main street to go back to town. But to make a long story short, she skidded and crashed into a lamppost on this. And then I had a feeling that I was being lifted up into the air. I was going up and up, and I heard a voice saying, "It's too late." I turned, I could see an ambulance down there and another car. I could see all this commotion, and yet I couldn't hear anything. I just thought, "Oh, what's happening down there?" Anyway, I just kept going higher and higher, and I couldn't see the commotion down there at all. And then I came to a place. It was like a very big tunnel I was going through, a very large tunnel because it took my whole body lengthwise. I floated up the tunnel in a spiral fashion. When I got to the top, I came to something that looked like a football field. It was all very bright, and there seemed to be a lot of sandstone, little pebbles and things. It was all light and a very blue sky. And right on the edge of the boundaries, there were green trees. Everything was very green. And I thought, "What am I doing here?" I looked around, and right in the distance, I could see a building. I had a feeling it was a church, but I couldn't see a steeple on it. I thought that as it was the only thing I could see, I should start walking toward it. When I got near, I saw the big church doors, which were just ajar. She thought she should go inside. There was a red carpet all the way down. It was a church, and yet it wasn't a church. I started walking down, and I was frightened. There were so many pews on each side, and each pew was filled with people wearing black robes with hoods. I couldn't see their faces, but if I turned my eyes, I could see the inside of the hoods were lined with red. There was no sound at all. I kept walking and walking, and then came to three steps, which I went up, then walked a little further. I then saw what looked like an altar, on which were six silver goblets and a big silver jug. I stood there wondering where I was and what I was doing there, when the door opened to the right of the altar, and out came the devil. He came over to the altar, looked me straight in the eye, and told me to pick up a goblet. I picked up a goblet, and he picked up the big silver jug and started pouring. I saw what he was pouring from the jug was fire, and I screamed, dropped the goblet, and started to run. I just ran and ran. I didn't know where I was running to. Then I saw a big fence, a stone fence, and the gates opened, and I passed through. Then I came to another fence made of iron bars, and that just opened, and again I ran through. All the time I was getting warmer and warmer and brighter, and that was it. I woke up, and there was a nursing sister sitting beside me. She was dressed in dark blue with a white cap. And I later learned she had been with me all night. Then there are some cases involving bewildered spirits, interesting to me because it suggests some descriptions of the lower astral plane. Moody, in his second book, Reflections on Life After Life, presents a case of this. Here he is interviewing someone who saw them. You mentioned seeing these people, spirits who seem very confused. Could you tell me more about them? These bewildered people, I don't know exactly where I saw them, but as I was going by, there was this area that was dull. This is in contrast to all the brilliant light. The figures were more humanized than the rest of them, if you stop to think of it in that respect, but neither were they quite in human form as we are. What you would think of as their head was bent downward. They had sad, depressed looks. They seemed to shuffle as someone would on a chain gang. I don't know why I say this, because I don't remember noticing feet. I don't know what they were, but they looked washed out, dull, gray. And they seemed to be forever shuffling and moving around, not knowing where they were going, not knowing who to follow or what to look for. As I went by, they didn't even raise their heads to see what was happening. They seemed to be thinking, well, it's all over with. What am I doing? What's it all about? Just as absolute, crushed, hopeless demeanor, not knowing what to do or where to go or who they were or anything else. They seemed to be forever moving rather than just sitting, but in no special direction. They would start straight, then veer to the left and take a few steps and veer back to the right. And absolutely nothing to do. Searching, but what they were searching for, I don't know. They didn't seem to be aware of anything, not the physical world or anything else. They were very bewildered, not knowing who they are or what they are. It looks as though they were had lost any knowledge of who they are, what they are, no identity whatsoever. This kind of dull, drab gray, seeming just to hover around. Then another interesting area are NDE experiences of children. And here's one or two of that type. This is about a four-year-old girl who descended the cellar stairs with a flashlight because the bulb at the landing had burned out. Years later, she reported it in this way. As I started to take the first step down, I flashed the beam of light up at the light bulb, curious to see if a burned-out bulb looked burned. I stepped out and fell into the darkness. The next thing I was aware of was being up near the ceiling over the foot of the stairs. The light was dim, and at first I saw nothing unusual. Then I saw myself lying face down on the cement over to the side of the stairway. A little surprised, but not at all upset at seeing myself that way. I watched and saw I didn't move at all. After a while, I said to myself, I guess I'm dead. But I felt good, better than I ever had. I realized I probably wouldn't be going back to my mother, but I wasn't afraid at all. I noticed the dim light growing slowly brighter. The source of light was not in the basement, but far behind and slightly above me. I looked over my shoulder into the most beautiful light imaginable. It seemed to be at the end of a long tunnel, which was gradually getting brighter and brighter as more and more of the light entered it. It was yellow-white and brilliant, but not painful to look at even directly. As I turned to face the light with my full body, I felt happier than I ever have before or since. Then the light was gone. I felt groggy and sick with a terrible headache. I only wanted my mother and to stop my head from hurting. And then here's one of a 14-year-old boy and his family trying to escape from their car trapped on a bridge by rising floodwaters, which was swept over the side and downstream. I knew that I was either dead or going to die, but then something happened. It was so immense, so powerful, that I gave up on my life to see what it was. I wanted to venture into this experience, which started as a drifting into what I could only describe as a long rectangular tunnel of light. But it wasn't just light. It was a protective passage of energy with an intense brightness at the end of which I wanted to look and to touch. As I reached the source of the light, I could see in. I cannot begin to describe in human terms the feeling I had over what I saw. It was a giant, infinite world of calm and love and energy and beauty. It was as though human life was unimportant compared to this. And yet it urged the importance of life. At the same time, it solicited death as a means to a different and better life, with all being, all beauty, all meaning for all existence, the energy of the universe forever in one place. As I reached my right hand into it, feelings of exhilarating anticipation overwhelmed me. I did not need my body anymore. I wanted to leave it behind if I hadn't already and go to my God in this new world. There's also a case that I have seen. I don't have the document on it, but it's fascinating, about a child who did not learn to talk until he was 3 or 4 years old, but who then claimed that he remembered an NDE when he was only 9 months old. And he spoke as crawling down the tunnel of light. You can imagine a child that can't even walk remembering having crawled down that tunnel of light. And Cindy and his mother did confirm that he had a life-threatening illness at that time. Now, finally, I'd like to turn to a few examples from the classical sources of the religions that seem to have parallels or bearing on this type of experience. The first one is an account of the journey of the soul after death from the Thompson River Indians in British Columbia, as collected in Mircea Eliade's book, From Primitives to Zen. And it was recounted in a classic anthropology source like this. The country of the souls is underneath us toward the sunset. The trail leads through a dim twilight. Tracks of the people who last went over it and of their dogs are visible. The path winds along until it meets another road, which is a shortcut used by the shamans when trying to intercept a departed soul. The trail now becomes much straighter and smoother and is painted red with ochre. After a while, it winds to the westward, descends a long, gentle slope, terminates in a wide, shallow stream of very clear water. This is spanned by a long, slender log, on which the tracks of the souls may be seen. After crossing, the traveler finds himself again on the trail, which now ascends to a height heaped with an immense pile of clothes, the belongings which the souls have brought from the land of the living, and which they must leave here. From this point, the trail is level and gradually goes lighter. Three guardians are stationed along this road, one on either side of the river and the third at the end of the path. It is their duty to send back those souls whose time has not yet come to enter the land of the dead. Some souls pass the first two of these, only to be turned back by their third, who is their chief and orator, who sometimes sends messages to the living by the returning souls. All of these men are very old, gray-headed, wise, and venerable. At the end of the trail is a great lodge, mound-like in form, with doors at the eastern and western side, with a double row of fires extending through it, suggesting the light theme. When the deceased friends of a person expect his soul to arrive, they assemble here and talk about his death. As the deceased reaches the entrance, he hears people on the other side talking, laughing, singing, and beating drums. Some stand at the door to welcome him and call his name. On entering, a wide country of diversified aspects spreads out before him. There is a sweet smell of flowers and abundance of grass. All around are berry bushes laden with ripe fruit. The air is pleasant and still, and it is always light and warm. More than half of the people are dancing and singing to the accompaniment of drums. The people are delighted to see the newcomer, take him up on their shoulders, run around with him, and make a great noise. Then, Plato. Moody summarizes Plato's position on the afterlife like this. Plato's writings are full of descriptions of death which are precisely like those that have been discussed, that is, the NDEs. For example, Plato defines death as the separation of the incorporeal part of a living person, the soul, from the physical part, the body. What is more, this incorporeal part of man is subject to many fewer limitations than the physical. Hence, Plato specifically points out in that time is not an element of the realms beyond the physical sensible world. The other realms are eternal, and in Plato's striking phrase, what we call time is but the moving, unreal reflection of eternity. Plato discusses in various passages how the soul which has been separated from its body may meet and converse with the departed spirits of others and be guided through the transition from physical life to the next realm by guardian spirits. He mentions how some might expect to be met at the time of death by a boat. That would be Charon's boat, of course, that takes them across a body of water to the other shore of their after-death existence. In Book 10 of the Republic, perhaps the most striking similarity of all occurs. There, Plato recalls the myth of Ur, a Greek soldier. Ur went away to battle, in which many Greeks were killed, and when his countrymen went to collect the bodies of their war dead, his body was among them. Was laying along with all the others upon a funeral pyre to be burned. But after some time, the body revived, and Ur described what he had seen in his journey to the realms beyond. First of all, Ur said, his soul went out of his body. He joined with a group of other spirits, and they went to a place where there were openings or passageways, apparently leading from the earth to the realms of the afterlife. Here the other souls were stopped and judged by divine beings, who could see at a glance, in some sort of display, all the things that the soul had done while in its earthly life. Ur, however, was not judged. Instead, the beings told him that he must go back to inform men in the physical world concerning what the other world was like. After seeing many other sights, Ur was sent back, but he said that he was ignorant of how he was returned to the physical body. He merely woke up and found himself on the funeral pyre. Then, of course, the well-known accounts in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which I'm sure some of you are familiar with, which describes how, technically what the Buddhists would call the karmic body or the thought body of propensities, since they don't believe in a soul in so many terms, departs from the physical body. It first encounters a tremendous light of the clear light of the void, as it's called, the Dharmakaya, absolute essence, absolute reality, brighter than 1,000 suns, louder than 1,000 waterfalls. But if this brightness is too bright for your eyes, then, so to speak, then you fall back and you begin to see on successive days the Buddhas of different parts of the mandala, very similar in a way to the beings of light that have been described in many of these NDEs. According to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, one can be liberated through any of these beings by accepting them as projections of your own consciousness and sort of merging in with them. If, however, you do not, you go around the circle of seeing them, then you go around the circle of seeing them in their terrible form, still ultimately the Buddhas, but in these tremendous Tibetan images of beings with arms and teeth hanging out, lapping skulls full of blood and things like that. These are also to be recognized, however, as ultimately projections of your own consciousness, but they certainly seem to be similar to the hellish aspect of the NDEs that some of these people have described, you've seen. And if even that doesn't liberate you through shock therapy or however, then you finally return for rebirth in this world through a process of the winds of karma blowing harder and harder upon you, going into a desert kind of place of rolling stones and so on, having a flash vision of your future parents in copulation, then going into a kind of swoon, maybe having a vision of Yama, the king of the dead, and then fainting, going into a swoon, waking up with this intermediate area ostensibly forgotten, at least on the superficial levels of mind, and you simply become a womb in a human body or dog body or whatever is your next destiny. And obviously there are parallels of this to the NDE experience too, which suggests part of its ultimate origin. Turning to the West, there is a case here from the writings of the great early medieval Pope, St. Gregory, which were collected by Carol Zaleski in her book, Other World Journeys, in which she found parallels to this experience in some ancient and medieval Christian writings. Gregory writes like this. 3 years ago, the same Stephen, whom we've been talking about, I guess, died in the virulent plague which devastated the city, Rome. Arrows were seen coming down from the sky and striking people dead. A certain soldier in this city of ours happened to be struck down. He was drawn out of his body and lay lifeless, but he soon returned to life and described what befell him. At that time, there were many people experiencing these things. He said there was a bridge under which ran a black, gloomy river, which breathed forth an intolerable, foul-smelling vapor. But across the bridge there were delightful meadows, carpeted with green grass and sweet-smelling flowers. The meadows seemed to be meeting places for people clothed in white. Such a pleasant odor filled the air that the sweet smell by itself was enough to satisfy the hunger of the inhabitants who were strolling there. In that place, each one had his own separate dwelling filled with magnificent light. A house of amazing capacity was being constructed there, apparently out of golden bricks, but he could not find out for whom it might be. On the bank of the river there were dwellings, some of which were contaminated by the foul vapor that rose from that river, but others were not touched at all. On the bridge there was a test. If an unjust person wished to cross, he slipped and fell into the dark and stinking water. But the just, who were not blocked by guilt, freely and easily made their way across to the region of delight. He revealed that he saw Peter, an elder of the ecclesiastical family who died 4 years ago. He lay in the horrible slime underneath the bridge, weighed down by an enormous iron chain. When asked why this should be, the soldier was given an answer that called to our minds exactly what we knew of this man's deed. He was told that he suffers these things because whenever he was ordered to punish someone, he used to inflict blows more out of a love of cruelty than out of obedience. No one who knew him is unaware that he behaved that way. And then he saw a pilgrim priest approach the bridge and cross it with much self-command to his walk as there was sincerity in his life. Well, there are other examples of that sort, but that will give the general picture of how this early Christian picture, you know, in some ways conformed with the idea of judgment, but also has themes common to the new death experience of a passageway of light, of judgment, of seeing one's past life, and all of that. Finally, I'd like to give an account from 19th century spiritualism, showing that many stories from that period have things in common with it too. This is the experience of a certain Dr. Wiltsie in Kansas, I think in the 1880s or so, from F.W.H. Meyer's classic work, Human Personality and Its Survival of Bodily Death. And it too is fairly long, so I'll be just summarizing a little bit of it. But he says after his apparent death, leaving the body, he discovered a small cord like a spider's web running from my shoulders back to my body and attaching to it at the base of the neck in front. I was satisfied with the conclusion that by means of that cord I was using the eyes of my body walking up and down the street. I walked but a few steps and again I lost my consciousness, and when again I awoke I found myself in the air where I was upheld by a pair of hands which I could feel pressing lightly against my sides. The owner of the hands, if they had one, was behind me and was shoving me through the air at a great, swift, but pleasant rate of speed. By this time, I fairly realized the situation. I was pitched away and floated easily down a few feet, alighting gently upon the beginning of a narrow but well-built roadway, inclined upward at an angle of something less than 45 degrees. I looked up and could see sky and clouds above me at the usual height. I looked down and saw the tops of green trees and thought it is as far down to the treetops as it is high to the top. Suddenly, at some distance ahead of me, three prodigious rocks blocked the road, at which sight I stopped, wondering why so fair a road should be thus blockaded. And while I considered what I was to do, a great and dark cloud, which I compared to a cubic acre in size, stood over my head. Quickly it became filled with living, moving bolts of fire which darted hither and thither through the cloud. They were not extinguished by contact with the cloud, for I could see them in the cloud as one sees fish in deep water. The cloud became concave on the undersurface like a great tent and began slowly to revolve upon its perpendicular axis. When it had turned three times, I was aware of a presence which I could not see, but which I knew was entering the cloud from the southern side. The presence did not seem to my mind as a form because it filled the cloud like some vast intelligence. Then To make a long story short, he heard the clouds seem to speak to his mind anyway from out of that intelligence, and he could understand them. Yet although the language was English, it was so eminently above my power to reproduce that my rendition of it is far short of the original. And the cloud said things like, "This is the road to the eternal world. Yonder rocks are the boundary between the two worlds and the two lives. Once you pass them, you can no longer return into the body." And then he gave him kind of a proposition. He said, "If your work is simply to write about these things that have been revealed to him," and this referred to some previous visions that he had too, I think, "and to talk to people about it, then your work is done, and you may pass through. But if your work is to publish them as well as to write what you have taught, then your work is not done and you can return." It's a sort of the ultimate publish or perish proposition, except the point is that you don't perish on the other side. However, he apparently felt that his work was not done. He did return to tell the story of this experience. But here again, you see the motif of a kind of line or barrier, which you can go up that far in an NDE, but you don't go beyond it if you're going to come back at all. And the confrontation with the pattern of your life and everything that is part of it, the so-called life review. One other book I'd just like to mention is by a man named George Ritchie, called My Life After Dying, because in his account he had experiences which seemed to really reflect all of the six lokas, or six places of rebirth, that are taught in Buddhism and sometimes in Hinduism too. The realm of the hells and the hungry ghosts and the animals, the titans, the human, and the gods. This experience happened when he was a soldier in World War II and was stationed at a base in Texas where he became very ill. He had, incidentally, just previous to his illness, been selected to return to medical school in order to train as a doctor, which is something that he very much wanted to do. But beginning in September in 1943, he collapsed and was reportedly pronounced dead in the hospital. But he left his body lying in sick bay and found himself moving over vast territory, asking the way back to Richmond, Virginia, where he had come from and where he was going to go to medical school. In this journey, he met the being of light, whom he identified with Christ, the Son of God, since he was a devout Christian. He saw his life review, including embarrassing aspects of his past. He saw a large city in which many servicemen were having a good time with drinking and partying in the bars and that sort of thing. A city, incidentally, which he later identified with Vicksburg, Mississippi. And he saw disembodied spirits like himself among them trying to participate, if only vicariously, as beings on the astral plane are sometimes described as doing in this kind of carousing. Then he came to what you might call a hell realm, in which he saw people who had committed suicide from hatred and jealousy, and who were continually arguing and fighting over things, including religious doctrines, all of which broke the heart of the Son of God. This last struggling and fighting perhaps reminding one of the realm of the Asuras or the Titans in the places of rebirth. Then he came to what he called a realm of knowledge, a place of continual growth in knowledge, the source of new ideas on earth, kind of like the Devic realm in Buddhism, or I would say the Devachan in Theosophical teaching, which is the source of the thought forms and so on that later become new developments on earth. And finally, the heavenly realm, finally returned to the body and eventually made it to Richmond by more conventional means to begin his medical training, later serving as an army medic and finally joining the faculty of the same school, the University of Virginia Medical School in Richmond, as a psychiatrist. While Ritchie manages to explain the world of this experience and also even reincarnation in conservative Christian terms, which seemed to be about all that he knew, it's hard to avoid noting parallel to spiritualist and Swedenborgian concepts. And as I said, I'm also struck by parallels to the six lokas, or places of rebirth of Buddhism. Here certainly seem to be the hell worlds, the realms of the pretas or hungry ghosts, the place of the titans continually fighting each other in battles marked by violence, anger, and stupidity, and the devic realm of the peaceful gods, the realm of learning. The only one missing is the only other loka that is ordinarily visible to us, that is the realm of animals. Now, in conclusion, it's evident that despite differences to some extent cultural, to some extent personal, these accounts all suggest a fundamentally similar view of death and the afterlife. It is perhaps more Neoplatonist in character than anything else. It presumes that the soul, or whatever one wants to call the non-material abiding entity in a human being, is separable from the physical body and has a separate destiny from it. After death, this destiny is pursued through encounter with benign beings, though evil and chaotic ones may also be on the scene, a review of one's life, an entry into a realm in which further progress is possible. Especially in the modern cases, the mood is predominantly happy and suggestive of endless joy and progress on the other side. But some hellish NDEs have surfaced, more reminiscent of segments of Ritchie's case, the world of St. Gregory, or the wrathful deities of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. However, it must be acknowledged that while the NDE seems to be to conform to a shamanist, Neoplatonist, spiritualist, and in regard to separation, encounter with the six lokas or the astral plane, there are other theological constructs which fit it less well. If the flat denial of an afterlife of the secularist is undercut by the experiences taken at face value, so also is the forensic judgment day and especially the polarized heaven and hell of Orthodox Zoroastrianism, Christianity, Islam, and other faiths. As we have seen, experiences that hint at the background of that sort of eschatology are certainly there. But the suggestion is that if absolutized, they are misunderstood. For the reality of the NDEs most often seems to be something closer to, say, Swedenborg or spiritualism's afterlife of pedagogical or learning stages. On the other hand, Eastern-based concepts of karma and reincarnation receive only occasional explicit support from modern NDEs. Reincarnation is not necessarily inconsistent with them. It is quite possible that the pleasant summer lands experiencers often find on the other side, with waiting relatives, is only like the Devachan of Theosophists or one of the Buddhist or Hindu heavens, a place of rest and recuperation between incarnations. Some experiencers have reported it so to be. The life review could be associated with the confrontation of one's karma, and we have seen some Hindu NDEs indicate as much. But admittedly, such interpretations are often only implicit and understated. At the same time, we must acknowledge that at best, an NDE is only a very partial glimpse of a new and baffling realm. Much that is important is undoubtedly omitted. Further, it must be granted that differences, sometimes inconsistencies, between NDEs are great enough that we must be hesitant about accepting any of them as literally true accounts of death or the afterlife. I'm convinced that they are religiously highly significant in the same way that mystical experiences and prophetic visions are. But like them, they are inevitably co-creations between the personality and culture of the seer on the one hand and ultimate reality on the other. Universal aspects of them, like the experience of light, the experience of a transcendent community, the relatives and helpers and guides meeting the guiding person, the experience of knowledge and accountability, but also of transcendence of one's earthly life, the experience of the separability of a spiritual self for the physical body, all suggest that something in the Eden NDE is set up well toward the ultimate reality side of the scale. If anything about them is true, it certainly is these features that seem to say something profound and universally true about human life. But on the other hand, the many variants and partialities in the concrete cases, as in all reports of mystical and religious experience, suggest that absolutes and relatives are thoroughly mixed, dwelling in what Heidegger called the house of language. But in conclusion, I'd like to reiterate that I believe the experiences can be an important ground for religious unity and interreligious understanding. First, despite detailed differences, they provide a concrete example of an important experience that seems to be common to all religious cultures. and therefore provides a possible empirical base for a major religious doctrine, since all religions virtually have a doctrine of the afterlife too. Second, the study of NDEs could provide a common task for religionists of many persuasions, something we could do together on the transcendent as well as the ethical level across religious lines. Third, whether one view the NDE as cognitive or illusory or some combination of both, ancient NDEs may well be the psychological experience that was the ultimate underlying basis for the doctrines and mythologies concerning the death and the afterlife in many faiths. Critiquing doctrines on the basis of the NDE, therefore, could provide a standard tool for looking at different religions and so help in perceiving their common themes on the afterlife. And at this point, I think I'll stop talking and give you a chance to contribute any input or comments or questions or anything that you have. Yes, sir.
I want to thank you, Professor, for a very explicit explanation of NDE. I have been studying this myself for many years, not as a professional. But I think the key element in this NDE study is the comparison of the out-of-body experience with what I would term the confirmed out-of-body experience. And you alluded to that, Professor, I think, in the case of the young man who died in Papua, and he came back with experience or knowledge of the death of another person. A young
right.
Person.
Mm-hmm.
And this person, he had no way of knowing. Now, you also cited Dr. Melvin Morse's book. He has two books. I think they're worth reading anyone interested in this area, because this is a pediatrician who has studied what I will now call confirmed out-of-body experiences of children and adults. And what this does is sort of indicate very clearly that knowledge is gained, which, unlike the typical near-death experience where you see a light or you have an experience which nobody can check except yourself. The confirmed out-of-body experience is checkable by an impartial, in this case, an MD and a staff. Well, they learn things, for example, like a person who is in a coma, maybe a mother in this case, where she sees her a granddaughter with mismatched socks in an outer room. Or a person who sees the nameplate of the nurse working on him while his eyes are closed and he has no knowledge. Well, this is very interesting because it fits in to the understanding that many of us have about the astral body and the mental body, and known in other traditions as the psychoneuetical bodies. So here we have what you discussed, Professor, the empirical basis, which is a commonality, and this is modern information. This doesn't go back to the time when we would stretch our faith to accept it. But this is information that's being published, being researched, and as you've expressed it, it doesn't satisfy you, the explanations of the humanists and the materialists, but there is the explanation of the spiritual aspect, and that these are bodies which, when you're in a coma, these bodies are released. And it doesn't have to be under a death experience. It has to be where the consciousness is subdued and the subconscious, which may be in the spirit of another dimension, another plane, develops these realities. So I want to thank you. Probably your wife has thought of these things, but this is the area, I think, which is especially critical and is the cutting edge of the issue of the
Well, thank you very much. And I think that is very important, because I know from her material also that there is increasing awareness and discussion of parallels between the NDE and the out-of-the-body experience. And that, in fact, some things that people have reported as NDEs apparently were not actually a life-threatening situation. Now, whether it was enough that they thought it was, or something else is hard to say at this point, and it's a very open area, but it seems that this may be an experience that does, as you suggested, I think rightly, you know, kind of flow into what we call out-of-the-body experiences, and that may just kind of like be the same thing under different circumstances. But there's a lot of work to be done in this. But thank you very much. I think it's a very important observation. Nobody else has anything I'd like to, or, oh, I've just got to say one other thing, and that is that one thing has interested me also, probably as a historian of religion, and I think this was suggested by that Thompson Indian account, is the not only the similarities between spiritualist and theosophical and Swedenborgian kind of worldviews that come out of this, but also very powerful similarities to the worldview of many primal peoples, shamanism and that sort of thing. And to my mind, this is something that may be kind of merging toward a convergence, because one thing that I've been struck with at the Parliament of Religions, actually, is the importance as kind of a background but growing presence of the primal religions, so Native American, African, and like that. At the Parliament here, the Native Americans have really been the ritualists and the performers, along with the neo-pagans who share something of their perspective. And I almost sort of got a feeling at some of the sessions of Parliament that the great religions that have come out of the what you call the Axial Age, you know, the founder religions, Buddhism, Christianity, and Confucianism, and so on, are, you know, in a kind of point of crisis in the modern world. They've created, as much as solved, the problems that we face. They sort of sense that almost they've shot their wad, and that we need to have some entirely different perspectives, and these seem to be sort of coming in the back door through Native Americans, other primal religionists who have a very different attitude, you know, toward the earth and the cycles of human life and so on. And of course, one way in which they have a different attitude from some of the great religions is that their perspective on the cycles of life and death, are really very congruous with theosophical and with the near-death experience kind of perspective. So there may be something that it seems to me is just kind of over the horizon that's really beginning to emerge and come together in a new stage of religious consciousness. You know, some ways it'll be new, in some ways it'll be a return to something very old. And for those of us that are theosophists, you know, this is very exciting because, I think primal religion really, the way they are the vision keepers of what we call the ancient wisdom, at least in its raw form, you know, the just original, almost unarticulated, but their concept of what human life and death, the cycles of life, what Helena Blavatsky and Isis Unveiled called the true origin of all religion, God and eternal spirit, you know, are there, and they're represented in their views of the transitions of life that are like those that people are also reporting in near-death experiences, or so it seems to me. Let's see, a gentleman here, you had something.
Yeah, I have a question about spirit attachments, if that's an appropriate question.
Right.
Would you comment on that?
Yes, well, of course, what Ritchie saw was that, I think it's something that C.W. Ledbetter also talks about in his writings on the astral plane, that many spirits on the lower astral plane, you know, are not able or haven't been able yet to release themselves from attachments to the grosser appetites of this life, or drink and sex and pleasure and that sort of thing. But since they can't experience them directly and physically, not being in the physical body, they may attach themselves to people, you know, like alcoholics and more or less debauched people and so on, that are themselves given to these appetites and try to experience them vicariously through them. And this can lead to various kinds of possession or semi-possession and so on, if you want to use that language. I'm not going to say too much about it, but it's if you want to read books like The Astral Plane by Ledbetter, it does seem to be a striking parallel to what Ritchie, who, as far as I can tell, was totally innocent of any exposure to this kind of literature. He was sort of conservative Christian, and that's all he knew, and yet he saw this same kind of thing during his experience. Yeah.
I'm wondering what you think about that one hellish vision. the woman who experienced that, I can't imagine that she came away with that and with good feelings about dying.
No, she probably didn't. All I know about it is the account, you know, as it was presented there. And I can, but I think it's, you know, increasing to recognize that people have these kind of experiences as well as the more pleasant ones. And, yeah.
In Raymond Moody's, it's either The Light Beyond or Heading for the Omega, I remember reading that hellish experiences at the NDE was less than 1%.
Yes, but I think the percent...
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what Moody says, but I think there are other people who have, are researching in this area would feel it has to be put higher than that. There's been a lot of them coming through. Oh yeah, here it is. It's in the Journal of Near-Death Studies, article called The Devil in Heaven, a Near-Death Experience with Both Positive and Negative Facets. And it goes on to say that, as the author of the article says, like other negative NDEers, Vera believes that the confrontation with the devil denoted God's judgment of her life, though this impression seems to be largely a posteriori. She believes the good and the bad in her life before the accident were of equal weight, and she was being asked to suffer a drink from the goblet of fire in order to make the balance favorable. By refusing to comply with the devil's demand, she was fated to suffer by way of compensation the physical disabilities that resulted from her car accident, almost like karma, I guess. In her own words, she was sent back by God to drink the cup of fire before she can return to that beautiful place. Further questioning confirmed that during the NDE, Vera had felt only calm and peace, free of any worry about the physical trauma of the accident or anything else, until the point when she became aware of the figures in the church and then came face to face with the devil. The case thus had qualities of a positive NDE until the episode in the church, after which the tone of the experience became negative. So that's kind of how, in her later thinking about it afterwards anyway, she came to feel about it. Now, I have to admit that personally, in reading this case, it seemed to me to have overtones of sounding more like just a dream, you know, than some of the cases. And so I'm not giving any particular interpretation. You know, I believe that dreams are significant too, but I don't think they're necessarily the same as an NDE experience. to my mind, anyway, that's the sort of thing that people often have in dreams that can easily move from beautiful to nightmare. I'm sure we've all had that experience and so on. But anyhow, that's what it says. Back here.
I recently went to a seminar with Brian Weiss, who wrote a master's psychiatrist that works with past life regression.
Yeah.
And then I guess during that episode, Jesus came to him and said, "Have you seen this? This is all, you know, of imagination."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I don't really know about the percentage of hellish ones. All I know is that, you know, judging from what I get mainly secondhand, but what's going on in this field is that more and more seem to be emerging and more attention is being paid to them. There's a woman named Nancy Evans Bush who's right now writing a book all about the hellish experiences and collecting them and so on. I still would say that at least in the modern experiences, the great majority of them are positive, but I think probably the hellish ones are more than the 1%. At least that's the impression I would get now. You know, it's interesting, maybe this is cultural. The medieval people, when life was a bit harder than it is today in a lot of ways, seem to have more experiences of hell than 20th century Americans. Maybe as our life gets worse and harder, we'll have more hell on the other side too. I don't it's hard. There's just so many things that are, you know, hard to sort out in this area. But it's fascinating. Yeah.
Has anyone gone into not just studies of the experience, but the psychological makeup, the and the religious background of people who have NDEs and then perhaps how the NDEs have affected those, their psychological makeup and their religious orientation afterwards.
Yes. Kenneth Ring, in his book, The Pointing Toward Omega, and one or two of his other books, he is a psychologist, and he has studied the psychological background of people that have had them. And he finds that, as is also the case with people that claim UFO abductions, that there is a high percentage, not all of them certainly, but a high percentage of people that suffered in childhood various kinds of abuse and neglect and so on. He doesn't say that the experience is just necessarily a compensation for that. He's rather careful about that. In fact, he also says that it's possible that people that have had this experience, which can produce, of course, multiple personality disorders and so on, can also open people for unconventional, kind of real but unconventional psychic experiences. On the other hand, Moody's cases, he's a little more sanguine than most of the other people that study these things, but his cases, he often indicates that, so far as he could tell, they were more or less normal people, but then I don't think he studied them in the kind of depth that Ring did from the professional psychological point of view. He picked up stories that people wrote to him or told him after his lectures and things like that. Yeah.
Well, the one thing that they have in common is that they either suffered a very serious illness.
Yes.
Or they were in some kind of an accident.
Right.
So if you come from the point of view that people attract things into their lives, they certainly have that in common, that they're the kind of people that attract those things into their lives.
Right.
Any other questions?
Okay, one more up here.
Well, I'd like to make a comment, kind of share an experience. Up until tonight, I thought I had a near-death experience. Now I'm kind of confused and I'm not too sure. As a result of a botched-up abortion, I found myself in the emergency room hemorrhaging. And I remember a lot of people working around me, about three on each side, frantically. And all I remember was floating up high, total blackness around me, real comfortable, and a lot of commotion going on underneath me. And then all of a sudden I tuned in to one of the people that was by my head, down below me, just saying that my blood pressure was 40 over 20, let's say, and dropping, and they couldn't stabilize me and take me to OR. And when I heard that, I felt like I jumped back down, and then my body jumped up. And that's when I kept trying to help them push all the blood out. And then all of a sudden, as they were holding me down, they were screaming at me saying, "No, you have to stay still. You can't push it out. We've got to stop it from coming out of you." And after that, my blood pressure came back to normal, and they took me to the operating
room. Well, that certainly sounds like the authentic first stages of it, as usually described, being above your body and seeing it down there and so on. It's certainly sounds like it to me.
Thank you very much. I think that we've had a very enjoyable evening, and you've given us a lot of food for thought and a lot of interesting data.